If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Kate Toome is a UK-based mixed-media embroidery artist who is creating her own personal cosmology. Kate was one of the finalists in the 2023 Hand and Lock Embroidery Prize, and her masks that are representations of a collection of gods that she is in the process of producing, or rather acting as a conduit for, are really standout items. As I was one of the judges, I was so excited to see her work when it came through, because it's almost like she's producing a world that she can see and is now sharing it with the rest of us. This is the first part of our conversation. I've known Kate for quite a long time, and we talk about the gods that she's making. We talk about how she started needlework and the fact that despite school not being the supportive environment for her creativity, and despite having somewhat of a hiatus in terms of producing work, in her late 20s, she found the groove for needlework once again and has never looked back. Katie's work's amazing. You're going to enjoy this interview. The second part of the interview will be out next week. I'm just going to leave it there. I'm not really going to say much more, because I think, well, first of all, go and find Kate on Instagram. She's known as Mother Eagle Arts. Go and check out her masks, understand her gods, and then enjoy the conversation. Thanks to everybody for listening. I'm really chuffed to have passed 5,000 downloads on the podcast now, and I hope that you enjoy it. Do feel free to drop us a line or to find us, share your thoughts on the podcast episodes as we share them on the Mr. X Stitch Instagram. Thanks for being here, folks. I'll be back next week. Enjoy the show. Should we talk about the Hand and Lock Prize? Should we just come in and talk about your amazing masks, which, when I was the judge of the Hand and Lock Embroidery Prize, and we look at all these bits and pieces coming through, and then I saw your work and I was like, oh, hell yes. Something like definitely different to all the rest. Tell me all about them, please.
I wanted to make masks. I think I first had the idea of making masks back in 2017, 2018. But at the time I was doing my portraiture, which is more animal portraiture, was exploring extinction and non-human losses. So grief has always been a sort of big theme in my work and mourning. But at the time I was very much in the headspace of, I need to feed Instagram every day, and I was posting every day, and I felt like I couldn't afford to step away from the sort of constant production line of what I was doing to give myself the time to figure out how to go into three dimensions and how to make kind of wearable sculpture. And so then, I know we'll talk about this, get onto this, but like when my husband died, it kind of massively influenced, like it was like all my creative energy got sucked out of me for a bit. And when I came back to it, I didn't want to make anything like what I was making before. And I was really like, now is the time to sort of make masks. But obviously the subject, because originally I thought I want to make death masks for extinct species. And actually now, with my own personal losses, it's more about the masks of grief, the masks of, and it's become this personal cosmology of like these, I imagine, these individual kind of deities. and mystical beings, and the different aspects of kind of processing my own feelings and my own emotions, my own worldview.
Because you're writing, having a personal cosmology is a pretty rad thing, but then also just creating gods, you know. Sometimes I'll read a comic book and I'll just be like, there's been a couple of stories I've read over time and I've been like, holy moly, like, where does that idea come from? And how do you like build this universe or whatever? And I kind of felt that's what was happening with you.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you can tell me about how the idea emerges and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a definite part of me that's always been there since I was a teenager. I've practiced witchcraft and I've been very into sort of magic, witchcraft, folklore, the occult. They're all sort of really big influences, but they really weren't in my work. And it was never sort of a conscious decision to sort of keep it out of there. But since I was widowed, I became 100% more spiritual. Like it really became a much bigger theme in my life. And so that sort of magic and mythology has made its way into my, there's a lot more artist in the art now, 100%. And when I make the masks, what I find now is that I often don't know exactly what the mask is until I've made it. Like I need to sort of look it in the face. And it tells me kind of what it's about. The origin of the masks is all different. The origin is also, I used to, when I was making work before, I was very research led. So I would do a lot of research around like the species, the politics. You know, I was using my art quite as an activist tool and quite politically engaged with sort of dismantling structures of oppression like white supremacy. So there's a lot of like much more political, much more intellectual driven origins. Now, you know, I make one of my masks I made because I had a dream where I turned into a bat. And so I made a mask about that. And it turned into being a mask all about being really sensitive and having like these big ears and these like big eyes and being very sensitive and sensitive to the world and kind of what that felt like being bereaved and feeling like a raw nerves flapping in the wind, and the face of that has become this big red bat that I had a dream about. So it's gone a very weird direction, and I love it.
There is a kind of alchemy there, isn't there? I remember Alan Moore, who's written loads of the best comic books in time or whatever, and I think he talks about magic, but he talks about magic being ideas becoming reality and going, that is literally
absolutely
magic, you know. And I guess that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. And Alan Moore, I loved Austin Osman Spare, who I also am very interested in. He was an occultist and a magician and an artist. And I remember there was a clip on, I think it was a South Bank show, and it was Alan Moore going to an Austin Osman Spare like exhibition. He's long dead. But he also created a lot of sigil magic, and I now create sigils and embroider sigils into the back of the mask. So I, as well as being art pieces, they are very much for me, and the destiny of them, I hope eventually, is that they become kind of ritual, magical, healing objects. So that there is this, I am very interested in this thing of like, you literally transform when you put a mask on, not only yourself, but for anybody looking at you, that a different person has come in, a different entity has come into the room. So there's a lot of these threads, no pun intended, coming into the work now.
Yeah. And then, you know, your work is very detailed and you use a lot of like beads and embellishment and bits and pieces that take time to make. So I guess the idea of there's a god who's got a bat face, by the time the thing's realized that you've really sat in that idea, and
yeah,
I mean, do you take notes about the story as you're making it? Because I feel like there's this, like, you're like a conduit to this idea.
That idea of a conduit is really important, and I'm really interested in that as well, of collaborating with unseen forces, collaborating with the other, this idea that material has an agency of its own. And you can see that more with like sculpture, like the clay is going to behave how it wants to behave, the paint drips are going to behave how they want to behave. With embroidery and the way I work, and it's a lot different because it's very controlled. By the time I sit down, I kind of have to have had I kind of have to have made all the decisions, and sort of a lot of the creativity is has kind of happened. There's obviously still decisions to be made in the making of it, but it doesn't change that much from the sort of starting point to the finish point. It is a lot more kind of, I'm in the design stages, excuse me, it's a lot more kind of, what are the colours? I sort of will go to my stash. I've got two massive cabinets full of colour coordinated beads and sequins, and I'll sort of go through that, look at the different materials, sort of see what feels like it's going to come through. I mean, for some masks, it's been like a piece of neon ribbon, and I've been like, that is precisely communicating this magical, mythical, omnipotent child mask of joy, which was one of the yellow masks in my entry for Hand and Look. Because prior, I thought, oh, I'm going to do this magical, mythical, omnipotent child mask all in gold, all in actual gold work. And then when I was sitting down to do it, I was like, there's something about it that's not quite working. And then I realized, no, it needs to be like acid yellow and like neon and like very kind of much more childlike, much more playful, much more curious and much less kind of rarefied, dillier. So I guess if there's a character out there and I'm trying to, be the conduit for it, kind of pull these, manifest these beings.
I love it, because the thing is, as well, is your colour choices, they're so, like, joyful. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think gods can run the risk of being, like, real heavy and real serious. And yours are just like, boom, I want to hang out with you.
Thank you. Yeah, me too. I think that these masks that I've made, how many have got now? I think I've got, my plan is with this particular body of work is to make 13 and have this court, this celestial court of deity of beings. And I've got about 6 or 7 now. And I am very interested in, I've just applied for some Arts Council funding to do some research, because there's sort of a 6-month research period, because I really want to understand the kind of global masquerade, global mask culture, and sort of how I'm in conversation with the mask culture and how masks have been used and magical objects and shamanism and, you know, all of this throughout the world and throughout history. But I have not seen work like my work. So I feel like this work within textiles or otherwise, it's very like, the colour is one massive thing, and just the fact that they're just completely blinged up to the wazoo. It's just, they're just so shiny and so holographic. I love a holographic. I love, you know, the clashing, the texture. They're very, maxi.
Gods, and we talk about life with the language that we have at the time. And I think so many of our stories about gods are so old, you know, medieval and all that, you know, predating those sorts of things. Right. So they're couched in that kind of language. So then it's interesting that your gods are now couched in like 21st century colours, 21st century thoughts. They're allowed to be electric because that's the thing. Whereas like gods of 1500 years ago, we didn't have electricity, so we couldn't embed that in the thinking or whatever. I think that's what's exciting. It's just genuinely like, these are like now gods.
That's a really good point. I think it's really interesting idea as well. And that's true that I am very interested in like futurism. And I do think of like, who are the gods that might come to us from the future or help us in society and in culture, kind of midwife us through this period of, because we're all grieving, I think, as well. Like the whole world is, I think everybody is grief, has grief. I think the whole world is going through this like incredibly difficult time of kind of collapse, and how do we revision the future, how do we get through that, how do we rebuild, and so I imagine that these are the entities that would come and shepherd us through that. These are the gods we could pray to be like, help us now. So it's very much like a futurism aspect of divinity.
And the funny thing I always think with futurism as well is that like a lot of the people that have futurist thinkings go, future is like now, but the cars can fly. Do you know what I mean? They always go like, future's like now. And you're like, no, it doesn't make sense. Future should be so abstract. Who are we to say?
Yeah, exactly.
I like that. We went to see the Turner Prize shortlist for 2022 back in the day, and I was really taken by the artist who's called Sin Wei Kin. And they had this kind of like, I don't know whether you would have seen it, but they had a sort of boy band, but it was like a boy band in the future. And it was kind of like they had videos of them doing dancing, but each of them had certain names. But it wasn't a boy band. It was more than that. It was almost like they were interstellar characters and it was all part of this universe. Mm. And then when I saw your work, there's a sort of resonance there as well, because with that piece, you just entered this room where the videos were there. And it was just like, sorry, you just entered this universe, you know, like it's just here. I'm not going to explain it. I'm just going to go, it's here. This is what it is. And then you leave the room and you're off again. And it's almost like a multiverse. And I kind of feel like that with yours. You know, someone discovers your work and you go, oh, you just happen to have wandered into this universe. You know, it's there. It doesn't need any more. Like, I don't need to hold your hand through it. You can enjoy it or you can bugger off.
I love that. I mean, it's really good. I think the thing is as well, I'm very new. This body of work's very new, and it's even newer in terms of external views of it. So that Hand and Lock Prize was the first ever like exhibition, public exhibition of any of them. And like I said, the sort of ultimate goal is to have like a whole kind of 13 of them. But yeah, I'm very interested in this idea of portals and kind of, and the mask is a portal. I think the mask as a portal, because you enter there a room that you enter when you put the mask on. You've kind of entered a room. You've sort of arrived in a different space. You've physically, literally, become a different version of yourself, and then the room changes and the view changes. And so I think they are very potent kind of transfiguration portals. And I have this vision that one day I'll put on an exhibition when they're all done, and I want to have, you know, performers wearing them. And so the exhibition is, they're not just sort of static objects, but they're actually being worn, and they can, you, so you can actually interact with them. And I think I've always been like really interested in what people's responses to my work. I'm very much like, I don't want to hold the hand of it, even though I'm kind of naming them and I'm suggesting what these masks are, who they are. I've always like loved when people are like, oh, I think it's this, you know. I think the yellow mask, for example, I've had people go, oh, you know, the elephant mask, and I'm like, what mask are you talking about? Or like, oh, it's like a walrus or a boar. And so that people see different things in it, and I love that you can see, you know, everywhere you go, there you are, right? So people will see themselves or see something in the work.
Yeah, it's the kind of, it's the love or the fun of abstract stuff, isn't it? Is it, you don't, when people do literal things and they reproduce a moment, it's like it's making people pay more attention to that moment. Yours is making people pay attention to the fact they've never seen this stuff before, and for them to open up their own exploration or something.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah. Right. Let's take it back to little Katie sitting at home, house surrounded by cross stitch, I believe.
That's true. Yeah.
Because you're self-taught, aren't you? So tell me, tell me about when the bug got you and how that all went.
I mean, so yeah, embroidery, cross stitch was the thing that just happened in my house. It was creative. So I think I always say like the material that I work in is sort of incidental. It wasn't that I was exposed to a lot of different mediums, and that was the thing that I chose to do. I just remember like my mum would do a lot of cross stitch kits, but I remember finding like graph paper, and she had a lot of Joe Verso books, which is you'll know, but it, you know, back in the day Joe Verso was the one, and these great books full of like little individual cross stitch motifs. So I remember I did like a map of Africa, and I put in like the sarcophagus, and I put in, you know, Egypt, and
I think,
you know,
I, and I was really like, oh, is that called like Around the World with Joe Verso? I think I've got that one. Yeah, exactly. Book.
So I was like, well, I'll try and like make it. So I was very interested in that, and then being able to like make up these pictures with little crosses and stuff. And then I went to, I did art at school, but I did an arts degree. I've got an arts degree. But honestly, education just taught me I wasn't creative. It really instilled in me that like I wasn't creative and I wasn't that good, because you know, you're grading people based, you know, A to D, whatever. You're saying like, this is good art, this is not good art. Can you draw this thing like real life? Can you, you know, depict realism or whatever? And I just found that the whole educational experience for me just made me feel very bad about what I was doing. Prior to that, I was always like in my room by myself, like making junk sculpture, and always just really wanted to be an artist. I was an artist, but definitely that was taught out of me. And I was more suited, I guess what I was displaying at school was more suited to sort of more academic side of it. So I did better at sort of art history than I did of actual practical art in terms of grading. And then when I went to university, I really wanted to do fashion, but at no point had I had a conversation with a teacher who then gone, right, well, you need to have a portfolio, you need to actually make stuff, you need to do this. So when I got to sort of 18 and was looking at universities, I realized I was completely unqualified. I just had nothing that was going to make someone give me a place at university to do something creative. So I ended up doing fashion promotion and illustration was the title of my course at the Surrey Institute of Art and Design, which was part of the University of Surrey, and I don't think it exists anymore. And it was much more like fashion writing, fashion photography, fashion like graphic design and stuff like that. So it was all this kind of very much more academic, like intellectually, you know, kind of responses to, or sort of
rather than periphery rather than the actual
very
subject,
very periphery. And it honestly just wasn't what I wanted to do. Like, I really regret, I wish I'd sort of taken a year out. I wish I'd kind of lived a bit in the world, but I was very much like, I guess like that was very sort of just the norm of like, you're going to go to school and you're going to do A-levels and you're going to go to university and that's what you do. And then you get a job. And so when I left university, I was just like, I don't want to do this. I don't know what to do. And I just ended up getting a job in a shop and just having a sort of normal retail job for ages. And then by the time I got to kind of my mid-20s, I just was so miserable, and I was like, I just need to do something creative. And so I went back to cross stitch initially, and I did this I charted out in felt tip pen this like very intricate skull from Grey's Anatomy and just did it all. It's on the wall of my bedroom now. And that was like the first thing that I'd done. Like, it's my own design, you know, it was my own kind of interpretation of it. And I did all the different colors, grays and stuff. And it just started from there, really. And initially I thought, all right, I need to make this commercial. So I tried doing sort of miniatures and sort of do things in jewelry form and make sort of miniature embroidered jewelry. But ultimately it took me till 2013. I was 33, so I'd been sort of messing, trying to like figure out what's my niche here. It was a really sort of slow process. I just didn't know what my creative voice was, and I didn't have any confidence in what that was either. I didn't believe that I was good enough and that I could do anything. So I was very sort of nervously doing that. And then after a few years trying to sort of make things that people would buy, in 2013, I was like, right, what I want to do is a great big multicolored crab, and I'm just going to do it. And I don't care how long it's going to take me. This is really what I want to do. And I just went all out. I didn't know what I was doing. It was way too big to be in a hoop. Like, my tension was crazy, but it was like this padded, you know, French knots, all multicolored stuff. You know, it was beautiful. And that was it. From then on, I was like, I'm just gonna make these like big pieces, and that's how it started.
Because I was reflecting back, right, and I know that I wrote about you in 2010, which is a bit bonkers. But then I feel like you took part. I did a pop up shop in Bedford in, I want to say like 2012, maybe 2011, and I feel like I had your stuff there. But like you say, it was really tiny. It was just really small pieces. I can distinctly remember them.
Yeah, so I taught myself by reading all the Royal School of Needlework stitch guides, and I really wanted to learn how to do stump work and gold work. So I I did a lot of, I had these little wooden frames made, and I made like little miniature stump work jewellery. And it was all kind of based on like magical plants, and there was a couple of little skulls in there, I think. And there was like a like stump work hawthorn blossom and stump work henbane, always like henbane. So that would have been around that time. I was getting there.
And was that, where did the name Mother Eagle come from?
Oh, Mother Eagle comes from a Jane's Addiction song.
Right.
called The Wrong Girl. And there's a line in there that says she's like a mother eagle coming down. And I remember I was trying to think of a name for like what my business was going to be, or what my artistic kind of personality was going to be. And this song is very much like, she's this really powerful woman that you don't mess with. So I thought, yeah, mother eagle is going to be mother eagle. So yeah, nobody ever asks that. It's great. I love when people ask that question. Nobody ever asks why it's mother eagle.
Because there's a distinct lack of eagles in your work. Do you know what I mean? You just
very much so.
I mean, I love the fact as well that you're self-taught. I was feeling, and I think maybe this is because I'm like a girl dad now, but when you're talking about the thing at school, you know, and you're talking about how the art that you wanted to make didn't tick the boxes, I guess with art, like I didn't do art at school. I did it for a very short time. I didn't do any GCSEs or anything. So I do not know what I'm talking about now, but I feel like it's almost like the curriculum says you have to learn the basics in this way so that you can fulfill an agenda of being able to do illustration or painting or whatever. But unfortunately, if you don't tick those boxes because your creativity is a bit like abstract, let's bolt a bunch of stuff together with a staple gun, it must have been quite, to just feel that creativity almost just like drain away because it's been taken down a path it's not meant to or something. I don't know if you're able to reflect back on that now.
Oh, yeah. And I've taught classes now on creativity to adults, and where I've just been like, I think it happens a lot. And I think there was this art teacher called Mr. Miles, and he taught my two sisters, and I thought, and he was like this legendary kind of, and I was like, oh, I want to go to this school because I'm going to, and you know, Mr. Miles is going to teach me. And I just have this like romantic idea, which I think we see in culture. We see this like this archetype of like this.
Oh, captain, my captain, I'll stand on a desk for you.
Yeah, who's like kind of sees something in you and is like, you know, and exposes you to like these like great artists and these crazy ideas and like gives you permission. And I mean, and honestly, like I say this now, like I am somebody still who my work has been pushed forward a lot. And I can look back on this at all the points because either I've given myself, but mostly somebody else, like I've seen somebody out in the world doing something that's made me feel like, oh, I've got permission to go in that direction too. So it's really done a lot. It did a lot to me to feel like I'm invalid. I'm not legitimate. I'm illegitimate. And it's not legitimate for me to push the boundaries or try and do something in this way. And I think the work I'm doing now is like a massive expression of how I'm not working in that mindset anymore, and I have figured out how to make these masks myself. It's a culmination of like all the techniques that I've taught myself, everything that I've given to myself. But I still do see when like I've seen an artist, like for example, I went to Berlin last year and did this amazing course with this artist Emily Hunt, who's like a massive inspiration to me. And seeing somebody like her who is working in like such a in a very sort of magical arena, like looking at wizards and magicians and occultists and really sort of swimming in those waters, looking at the great female surrealists like Leonora Carrington and Nikki de Saint-Phalle and just people who are using like magic as their inspiration for their work. Just maybe go, oh, I can do that. Oh, I can do that as well. Like, I'm really interested. I know loads about that. I could use that too. And it's not that it didn't occur to me, but there's just something about the morphic field. I was listening to this book the other day, and it's talking about in physics, the morphic field, and how it's interesting how, like, when one thing is done by one person, suddenly, like, it happens all over the world. Lots of people do it. And I feel like I've got my own kind of morphic field thing going on with art, where Grayson Perry is another one. Like, I really got into Grayson Perry last year, and I was like, fuck, here's somebody who's like a crafts person, you know, who's a potter essentially, but they're like, I don't give a shit about that. Like, I don't and this is in no way to be disparaging about the textile world, but like it's incidental to me that it's textiles. I don't really have any attachment to, like, I can do it and I've done it and I have done it in the past and I have swum in those waters before and felt like this is where I am legitimate and I need to stay here. So I know the rules of embroidery and I know the techniques and stuff like that. But now being able to like kind of throw that out and be like, oh yeah, but it's incidental that it's textiles. Like I'm just making the face of like this moth goddess who's really all about destruction and she came out of a cauldron. And seeing artists like Grayson Perry, for example, who is essentially a potter, but is just so much more than that and is just working in bronzes and, you know, has this incredible exhibition at the British Museum. And I'm like, that is goals. Like that is what a vibe. Like that is exactly the kind of, I think we need way showers, you know, I think we need people to kind of light the way a bit. And I think it's really important. So I didn't get that from school. And so the romantic idea of like captain, my captain, the kind of Dead Poets Society, like that kind of didn't happen for me in school. It's happened to me later in life. But I think for me, being able to sort of find these mentors has really allowed me, like given me that permission that I've really craved all my life to be able to go, I can do my own like really special, weird stuff that no one else is doing and be good at it and do it to a really like high standard.
I was thinking what you were saying a second ago, and I don't know, this might not sound right, but you know, like sometimes people, if they're having a religious experience, have to speak in tongues. But because that's the only way they can communicate what they're saying. And it almost feels like with your mask, you're going, look, it has to be needlework because that's the language that they have to come out in. Do you know what I mean? It's that thing, isn't it? Of not going, you're not going, I'm doing this in needlework because I want to challenge the context of needlework as an art form. And I know that has been part of your thing, but now it almost feels like you say, like you've opened up the pause, you've gone, sorry, all the gods are made of needlework. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, that's the way it is. Yeah, deal with it.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I want them. I've said this for a long time, but like for me, I want the work to transcend the medium. Like it's not about needlework. A lot of textile art is, and that's great. And that's, I'm not saying that that is any less or any higher or lower or anything like that. But for me, what I want is for people to have an experience with the work as an art object. And it's secondary, the fact that then they go, oh my God, it's made of sequins or oh, it's embroidery or whatever.
Yeah.
It's, I want it to have that transcendence.
Yeah. I love the fact that you were so personally driven that you taught yourself all of these things, you know, like diving into the RSN books and all those kind of things. I mean, were you still just like working as a normal Katie and then doing this stuff in the evenings and stuff?
Yeah. I worked for Topshop at the time. I was a style advisor, head of style advisors for the North. So I used to travel around like doing the personal shopping and like, you know, helping teenagers be fashionable for a few years. Wow. At the time.
It's like you were the god of Northern teenage fashion for a second then.
Yeah, maybe. Like corporate, very, very corporate, very, very corporate retail, very sort of, and like, yeah, not particularly creative, very much like realizing other people's visions still.
And then on the evening, you just come home and you're like, right, chapter 32, stump work.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me do this hawthorn blossom real quick.
Did you go and do classes and stuff?
No, the only class I've ever done is I did a weekend class with the Royal School to do gold work, just because I was like, it's very expensive and I don't want to like experiment with gold just because it's so expensive. So, I did a coloured metal work weekend class, like a 2-day class. That's the only training I've ever had.
Wow. I wonder, it's a funny one, isn't it? Maybe you'll learn some techniques that will totally unlock a load of productivity for you, or maybe it'll turn out you've just worked it all out for yourself or whatever in your own Royal School of Needlework event or whatever. But
all right,
I admire the passion because it's obviously it's just a thing that's there, isn't it? And I have these conversations with people, like I was talking with Ruth Norbury recently and she started stitching when she was about 6 and never stopped. And, you know, it's just, I just love that. I love that the burning is there, the passion is there, and that it's, you can hold on to it. And yours has obviously taken a bit of a bruising through your teenage years, but I love that it came back so strong that you just made yourself learn this stuff.
Yeah, I did. And also, you know, the honest truth is that, again, talking about like permission and comfort zones. Like, I wouldn't have felt comfortable like going into painting because it wasn't something that I had that sort of familiarity with. I just felt safe with needlework and textiles because it was just something that I was used to doing. So, and you know, I remember like my mum coming over once and teaching me how to do a French knot, and after that I was like, right, that's it, I can do everything now. French knot was my gateway drug, and I could do all the special fancy stuff after that. But yeah, again, it was that kind of like comfort. It was the comfort zone that I had.
Mm. And how do you feel when you're doing the work?
That's a good question. How do I feel? I'm always really excited to start a new one. And I'm always really like, I've just finished one. I've just finished a mask based on the Empress card in tarot. And she's basically all holographic white. As a piece, it looks like a big mother of pearl shell. And she's got like these hand dyed velvet strawberries with Swarovski crystal bead like seeds. And she's like super a big gold, great big gold earrings. Like, she's wicked. And but the next one I'm going to do is like a trickster rabbit mask based on Bugs Bunny, because I feel like Bugs Bunny is a trickster god, and I just love Looney Tunes, and I just Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner, I feel like. So yeah, so I'm like really like, oh god, the next one, and it's going to be like, I'm going to do it in impossible colors. I've just been researching about impossible colors, which are like colors that just shouldn't, they don't exist on the light spectrum. Oh, it's wicked, it's so fascinating.
Go on.
Yeah, okay, so I'm really interested in tricksters and sort of this idea that, and this the way that Bugs Bunny is like, what's that? Like, he just is like, oh, I don't know, let's just play. I'm going to stick a bit of dynamite down Elmer Fudd's trousers. Who knows what's going to happen? Like, that's this curiosity energy, this like, fuck it up a bit and see what happens energy. There's something really healing about that and something really good for me in that. But Bugs Bunny is like this real archetype for me. I really love it. So I'm going to do this rabbit mask. And then I discovered this thing about impossible colors. So I was looking at magenta, and magenta apparently is an impossible color because it is comprised of red and violet, which are opposite ends of the light spectrum. And so when we see magenta, it shouldn't exist. It doesn't exist in light. Right. And right. Then if you look on I would advise any listeners to just go on the Wikipedia page for impossible colors, because it will blow your mind. So I'm going to do this mask in Stygian blue, which is a blue that is both black and impossibly saturated blue, and hyperbolic orange, which is an orange that is more than 100% saturated. And it's going to have magenta accents. So yeah, I know. So this idea that like this trickster god, which is made of these colours that don't exist, but you can see them. And then just think more ideas of like, you know, goldfish apparently can see true yellow, but we can't. So our brain just makes up what yellow is. But goldfish actually have cold cones in their eyes that can see actual yellow. But we don't know what yellow actually is. We just know what we call yellow. Yeah, so right. Just stuff. I'm just like, that's just mad to me. Dude. So doing a mask about that. Yeah, there's always like so much energy, so much like fun, and like can't wait to get on with it. That's how it feels to do my work.
That very much sounds like the sort of conversations you have when you're a student and it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you know what I mean? Like, dude. Impossible colors, dude. You won't believe it. Yeah, man. Have you heard of Vanta Black? Do you know about Vanta Black? It's like the blackest color ever invented. Like, they've worked out a way of like.
Oh, I've seen the
spirit. It'll absorb, like, yeah, that just suddenly you paint a thing and you can't see it. 99% of light. Nothing or whatever. That's just mental, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love that. I feel like, though, if you actually did something with Vanta Black, I feel like you might lose your mind doing it, because you're stitching. Like, if they made Vanta Black thread.
Put the mask on and it's like.
Yeah, and you're just gone. You're just a vortex.
Just gone. Just a void.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.